This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
This is The Big Take, the best of Bloomberg's in-depth original reporting from around the globe.
This is a really fast-moving story.
It's caused a lot of outrage among investors.
This is so fascinating.
The market shut down in a way it's never done before.
That's going to have consequences for years to come.
The Big Take on Bloomberg Radio.
Yeah, it is time for the Bloomberg Big Take. It's also among our most read on the Bloomberg. It's about the world's richest family worth at least $300 billion. And no, it's not the Waltons. And among the secretive families, Personal Holdings is an investment firm which has seen its value surge almost 28,000% over the past 5 years.
Let's get into it with Bloomberg Wealth reporter Devin Pendleton joining us via Zoom from Brooklyn. Devin's story, as Carol mentioned, is today's Bloomberg The Big Take. Check out The Big Take podcast at Bloomberg.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't miss The Big Take on Bloomberg Radio weeknights at 11 p.m. Wall Street time. So Devin, the Al Nayan family, who are they?
So they are the ruling family of the UAE and also Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi is the capital of the UAE. And that's important to note that they've become extremely powerful because Abu Dhabi, which is a relatively small city, and also an emirate, it's kind of like there are seven emirates that make up the UAE. The Al Nahyans rule this little emirate, which has all of the oil and gas of the UAE. So that's about 6% of the world's reserves.
That's some serious stuff. An understatement. First of all, if they're secretive, how tough was it to kind of assess their wealth?
It was really tough. And it was tough partly because they're very low profile. They're very low key. I mean, they have like a really quiet presence. I mean, obviously that they are political figures, they're rulers. One of the brothers that we speak about in the story is the president. Another one's the national security advisor. But they're not very public people. But the other thing that makes this very tricky is that the wealth is quite inextricable. I mean, it is extricable, but it's very difficult to kind of tread the line between what's personal money and what is state money. That has been sort of an ongoing situation with a lot of the royal families in the Gulf region, so also Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait. It's quite similar, but what's interesting about the Al Nahyans is that they have become very prominent investors in their own right, in their personal capacity in recent years. And that's made it easier to kind of distinguish how wealthy the family is individually. So we really do our best to kind of separate out state money versus personal fortune, because we don't want to assume that, yes, even though they're the rulers here, we're not saying that all of the state's assets belong to them. We're really trying to look at what is their actual personal wealth.
Well, let's talk about some of those personal investments. They include in companies like SpaceX, Rihanna's lingerie line. We got fast food. We got more. What's sort of a commonality that threads these investments together?
Yeah, commonality would probably be they are aggressively diversifying. So kind of this investment vehicle that they own, this investment vehicle has bought stakes, and like you mentioned, Tim, in SpaceX and in Rihanna's lingerie line, all they've bought stakes in businesses all over the world and in all kinds of industries. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to do kind of exactly what the state sovereign wealth funds are trying to do. They're trying to diversify beyond oil because they are well aware that oil is not going to be powering the world forever. They want to ensure that all of this money they've generated over the years from energy is going to be well diversified and help support them for years to come. Family has the exact same concern. The foundation of their fortune is also from oil. So they want to diversify and they have so much money right now because oil prices are high and they see bargains everywhere they look. There's really kind of no industry that they've ruled out.
You know, it's interesting, and we know this, right, with the Middle East, money often means also lots of power. And I do wonder about the influence of this family. And I guess I asked you this, Devin, because so much when we're talking about the Middle East, when it comes to investing or influence, we talk about MBS, right? Mohammed bin Salman. So I'm just curious how this family fits in when it comes to influence in the sphere.
Extremely influential. I mean, I would put them almost on a par with MBS. I mean, MBZ is, as he is known, is the president. MBZ is kind of famously was the mentor to MBS. So he, in many ways, kind of is quietly was the first example for this sort of statecraft investor type. And they really, really are, I mean, you can't really underrate how powerful this family is. Their country is very small, but they do sit on an enormous amount of oil money. They are very, very active investors. They are also becoming extremely influential in the region. Investing in companies in Egypt and in Turkey and in India, which is a little bit further outside the region. But they are investing in strategic sectors there. So in energy sectors and in food, in these critical areas, they're swooping in. They're making sort of key investments in important areas. They're forming their relationship at the government level and also at the investment level. I mean, in a sense, they're almost kind of becoming like an IMF-like figure. They're with the money when they need it.
20 seconds, Devin. At the same time, you write that there's concerns that their international holding company is too opaque for some institutional or international institutions, rather, to bet on. What can you tell us?
Yeah, the investment firm there, which is publicly traded, it's traded on the Abu Dhabi Stock Exchange, which is owned by a state fund, which is chaired by one of these family members. There's just a lot of linkages. There's so much overlap between state money and personal money. And it's really sort. I mean, it's not a widely held firm. It's quite concentrated. And it's hard to sort of explain and defend how quickly its stock has gone up. So that has a lot of, you know, international investors cautious.
Well, it's a fascinating tale. And as we said, it is the Bloomberg Big Take today and among our most read. Bloomberg Wealth reporter Devin Pendleton joining us via Zoom from Brooklyn. I always feel like when we get in some insight into those big Middle Eastern investors, it's just a reminder that they are getting out of fossil fuels. They are into diversification. Tells you a lot about where we're going. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Among the great business rivalries of our time, Tim, no doubt about it, is Airbus versus Boeing. And they own the aerospace industry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's pretty much nobody else out there when it comes to narrow bodies and wide bodies here. Okay, so they've got a lineup of products that compete with one another. You got Airbus's answer to Boeing 737. It's the A320. But that's about to change because Boeing recently revealed that it's not going to design a new aircraft this decade, leading it without a competitor to Airbus's smaller A220. With more on her story, it's in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's on newsstands tomorrow, but you can read this story online and on the Bloomberg terminal. We got Julie Johnson, aerospace reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from Chicago. Julie, good to have you with us this afternoon. What's going on with this A220, which, by the way, Carol and I actually got to fly on earlier this year when we flew to Dallas?
Well, I know. It's a fantastic plane. I've flown on it a couple of times as well, and I'm a big fan.
There's a window in one of the bathrooms. That's yes, like one of the big highlights, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm just going to warn you, Julie, Tim is really, really into planes.
I know. She knows. I bother her all the time with like non-work stuff.
Just like when we're picking flights to go places, he's like, well, you know what kind of plane that is. So anyway, so go ahead. Tell us about your story and what you dug into.
And by the way, Tim, I approve of this behavior.
Thank you.
Yeah. So anyway, it's really the product strategy gamesmanship is really fascinating between these two. And as you hinted at, they've had, you know, pretty much a 50-50 duopoly of plane making for years, decades. And that started to change recently. Airbus has taken control of the most important segment of the market, which is narrow bodies, with a plane that has called the A321neo that has just been a runaway sales success. So Airbus is doing really well at the top of the market. And weeks after Boeing CEO basically said, look, we're just not doing a plane this decade, Airbus's CEO told Bloomberg, hey, well, funny enough, we are looking really closely at a new member of the A220 family that would go right at the heart of Boeing's product lineup. Now, just a little bit of history here, but Airbus got the A220 at a fire sale. I mean, I think it was a dollar or euro. I forget the currency. From Bombardier, it was a pittance back in 2018, total fire sale. And when they picked up those first two A220 models, they also inherited really detailed engineering designs for a third and largest member of the family called the A220-500. And so that's the plane that Airbus is now talking up publicly. Do you want me to go on? Because there are so many aspects to this. It's really fascinating.
Well, first of all, what does it mean for Boeing if they don't have a comeback against it?
Well, so there are a couple of things going on. And basically, this is a classic pincer move, where Airbus has the top end of the most important market in aerospace, narrow bodies, with the A321. And they would be coming back with a smaller plane that's targeted right at Boeing's bestseller, which is the MAX 8. So if Boeing doesn't have a comeback, that means, you know, they continue to bleed even more market share to Airbus, and it's not good.
But Julie, you mentioned the MAX 8, so we got to go in on the 737 MAX and all the problems that Boeing has had. How much of Boeing's history of mismanagement with regard to the 737 MAX and the wake of the two crashes that killed hundreds of people a few years ago and the 20-month grounding of the plane, how much of that has to do with Boeing not coming up with a competitor to this A220?
Well, I think that Boeing's got $57 billion in debt right now, and that's a result of COVID and the MAX crisis. They had to stop building the MAX for I forget how long. It was a few months in 2020, but they were knocked out of sales for a long time. So anyway, the financial damage is going to be with Boeing for most of this decade, and that's a really big factor as to why they're just not in a position right now to do a new plane. But the MAX 8 has done really, really well in the market, I believe it's outsold the A320neo, so that's the comparably sized Airbus model, and so it's definitely a success in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And right now, Boeing's finances are riding on that plane.
Well, and the story that you guys report out says that 737 MAX 8, that sales restart handed Boeing a victory over Airbus last year, the competition for the most aircraft orders. So, Julie, the back and forth, I feel like, you know, anybody who's been in this industry of covering business news, business stories, you know, from year to year, it's like Boeing got this order, you know, Airbus got this order, and kind of the back and forth. But I do wonder, is it potentially setting up for, you know, Airbus to have a longer term advantage here, or how do you see it?
Well, I think Airbus, we should, you know, if everything goes Airbus's way, they will dominate the market, not just this decade, but into the next decade as well. And so I think some people are really worried that, you know, Boeing might be facing sort of a slow slide into mediocrity. But then I've got to just throw out just a grain of salt here, because none of this is going to happen anytime soon. Airbus has got some huge issues of its own, and it, you know, its production system is a mess right now. So they're not in a position to take on a new plane. And if they pursue the A220-500, they're going to cannibalize one of their most profitable models, which is the A320neo. So it's risky for them as well.
Yeah, it's tricky, no doubt about it. Love the story. Tim's really into planes, and we have a lot of fun with it. So great to get into this story. It's a new issue of Bloomberg Business Week that comes out tomorrow on newsstands, but this story already you can find at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and it is on the Bloomberg terminal. Julie Johnson, when it comes to things up in the air, we like to talk to her. She is aerospace reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Chicago. Actually, I grew up with a dad who was an aerospace engineer. We did the same thing. We'd look up the plane and you'd be like, it's such and such a kind of plane. And
yeah,
I know you do that kind of thing.
I mean, that's why I'm so into planes too. My dad grew up on an Air Force base, so we just used to go to air shows all the time. And yeah, who doesn't love planes, Carol?
You have great advice, like when we're picking flights, like, we don't want that plane because we can't lie flat as we're flying across the U.S. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We in the past have talked about how we like getting to talk to the city's mayors across the United States. We get some insight on life on the ground, on growth, labor markets, investment, innovation, and more. And today, Tim, we're focusing on Tulsa, Oklahoma, which Bloomberg News reported on back in September that a consortium that includes Devon Energy, Williams, and some others partnering with a Tulsa nonprofit founded by the George Kaiser Family Foundation in hopes of bringing as many as 200,000 energy tech jobs to Oklahoma over the next 5 to 10 years. So we want to get a feel, a lay of the land when it comes to that economy.
We got more with the city of Tulsa. We welcome Mayor G.T. Bynum here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Mr. Mayor, good to have you with us here at Bloomberg. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Hey, you know, I want to get to the detailed programs that you're working on, but talk a little bit about the economy that, as you're seeing it right now in Tulsa, because yesterday we heard from the big bank CEOs, and the overwhelming theme was they were concerned about us heading into a recession next year, potentially in the second half of next year. What do you see?
Everything in Tulsa right now is very strong. I mean, we're seeing probably the greatest moment of investment in the history of the city is occurring right now, both across the public and private sectors. Our core industries in Tulsa, of course, are energy and aerospace, but we're also seeing a tremendous level of interest and investment around advanced mobility. That's something that we just secured. We were one of 21 cities out of 600 that applied that secured a Build Back Better regional challenge grant from U.S. Department of Commerce. And we're using that to build the advanced mobility industry in Tulsa that's expected to develop 30 to 40,000 new jobs over the next few years with a projected economic impact between $3.5 and $5 billion. So right now, I mean, the economy is very strong. For us, I think, and as a mayor, the big concern is inflation and the challenges that presents with keeping up with cost costs as a city government, where we have to have a balanced budget every year, and providing the level of service that people expect when the cost of doing everything, whether that's fixing a street or hiring a police officer, is dramatically more expensive than it was just 2 years ago.
We also want to mention that Mr. Mayer has participated in the Bloomberg Harvard City Leadership Initiative and also the Bloomberg Philanthropies City Data Alliance. Of course, these have been founded by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Mayor Bynum, what would you like your economy to be? Energy has been a blessing, mm-hmm. right? But it can be a curse in terms of overexposure. Where do you want your economy to be in, let's say, 5 years?
Well, I think the key for us is that we want our economy to be diversified and be one where it's creating equality of opportunity in our city. We have consolidated all of our economic development efforts in Tulsa behind that goal of using economic development to drive equality of opportunity in our city. We think that the advanced mobility industry presents a really great opportunity right now in the history of that industry.
So when you say advanced mobility, you mean specifically what and who?
For us, what I'm talking about there would be drones, electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles. The funding that we receive from U.S. Department of Commerce, we're using to build a 110-mile drone testing corridor through the Osage Nation that they are going to build. We're building an autonomous vehicle.
So they benefit.
Correct. The Osage Nation. Tulsa is at the intersection of three tribal nations, the Osage, Cherokee, and Muscogee Creek. We work with all three of them on our economic development efforts. But we think that that one is a big one. The other key one for us, Tulsa actually, we get no attention for this, but it's kind of by design. The University of Tulsa is probably the leading university in the nation when it comes to graduating cybersecurity graduates. Mm-hmm. By its nature, is not one that you put billboards up and advertise.
But it's so funny that you say that, because our guest at the end of the broadcast is all about kind of a group, speaking of tribes, like a group of folks that are dealing with ransomware specifically.
Yes.
So cybersecurity is a huge, huge industry.
Oh, 100%. And it's not going to go away. It's not a fad.
Right.
It is something that's growing. And so the great challenge for us is to have that intellectual capital at our university, and how do we translate that into new companies and job creation?
How do you get those students who graduate to stay in Tulsa and work for companies that are there? I mean, look, it might be easier than ever because people can work remotely with jobs like these.
Can I
today.
Just say, for those who are watching on Quick Take and YouTube, you can see, well, maybe the mayor, he kind of chuckled at that. So, right, because it is, you know, educate them, but you want that younger generation to stick around.
Oh, no. I mean, that's the challenge is federal agencies historically have just vacuumed up all these graduates and they've gone all over the world rather than staying in Tulsa. You mentioned the George Kaiser.
So they're spies, is what you're
you
saying.
You said that, not me.
Okay. Go on.
You mentioned the George Kaiser Family Foundation. They're actually working with the University of Tulsa to lead an initiative that spurs the growth of companies by graduates coming out of the University of Tulsa's cybersecurity program, so that it has two arms. It has one where it's preparing graduates for public service, and then it has an
arm. Or spying, you can say. No, I'm
for
just
public
kidding.
Service, which Sorry. Might be a public service. And then an arm that's there for business growth and entrepreneurship.
What's the trickiest part of your job right now in terms of as you look at the economy? There's a lot of uncertainty. Tim kicked it off the conversation about we're trying to figure out what next year holds for us. Even in a downturn because of the energy pad and the energy crunch that we've seen, does that give you guys a lot of room?
I mean, the trickiest part of my job right now is that there is so much growth that we don't want to get out too far over our skis where we find ourselves in a position. I started as a city councilor 2 months before the Great Recession began. And I saw what happens to a local government that builds in costs that all of a sudden you wake up one day and realize you can't cover anymore.
Right.
And you have to start looking at laying off police officers and firefighters, and no mayor and no city ever wants to be in that position. So how do you maximize the growth of our city and move with the opportunities we have before us right now? But to the point you're raising earlier about what those CEOs are saying, we don't know what's waiting for us in 2023 or 24. And the economy always comes down at some point. And so when will that be? And how are we being very secure and being prepared for that while trying to maximize growth?
We had Mayor Maddie Parker from Dallas-Fort Worth here.
Yeah,
Fort
she's
Worth
great.
Mayor.
Yeah
she's just
great.
A few weeks ago. I asked her this question too, because both of you are young, politically moderate Republicans. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it's tough to be a moderate Republican when you see what's happening in the Republican Party on a national level? Like, how does that make your job more difficult?
Oh, I think it's tough to be a moderate anybody right now. I mean, I think that the greatest threat to our country right now is the political polarization that occurs. It's one of the reasons I'm so thankful that I work in local government, where Republicans and Democrats and independents still do work together to solve practical problems. I mean, you mentioned the Bloomberg City Data Alliance. That's one of the things I love about, as a mayor, being able to utilize data. It's a tool where you can bring people of different political philosophies together and solve problems that they don't have to be philosophical debates. They can be practical problems that you solve. How do we build a better street? How do we hire more police officers?
Does it make
a difference? Yes.
Because, you know, we're very
makes all the difference
number
in the world.
Data, you know, centric. And I feel like data tells our numbers or information tells a certain story or tells the truth. But does it resonate no matter what the political leanings might be of a party that you're talking to?
It 100% does. And I say this as somebody who worked as an aide in Congress for 6 years before I moved home and ran for the city council. All of our street projects are selected based on analytics. The numbers that we determine on how many police officers we need, that's based on analytics. Mm. We're trying to build out more and more utilizations of data into the work we do as a city so that we're taking that partisan polarization that you see so much at the federal level and boil it down into more practical problem solving that people can get around. And by the way, my mayoral administration, it's equally divided between Republicans, Democrats, and independents. Our city council is the same way. At the local level, you still see that collaboration that is non-existent at the federal level today.
We'd be remiss. We've only got about 30, 40 seconds. But the legacy of Black Wall Street, mm-hmm. How does that factor in?
Well, I mean, that's driving so much of what we do right now. I ran for mayor. I decided to run for mayor the day that I realized that there was an 11-year life expectancy gap between kids growing up in the predominantly African-American part of Tulsa and the rest of the city. As a dad of two kids, I wanted the kids growing up in that part of the city to have the same opportunities that my kids do. And so everything that we're doing as a city right now around economic development and city services is around creating that equality of opportunity so that Tulsa really can be a city where every kid has an equal opportunity for a great life, regardless of the part of town they're growing up in.
Well, we wish you luck with that mission and come back and tell us how things are going.
Thank you.
So appreciated. G.D. Bynum, Mayor of Tulsa, Oklahoma, joining us here in our Interactive Broker Studio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, let's get to it. We've got about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Bouncing around on the equity trade, as you heard from Charlie, a little changed overall, just down a hair on the S&P. NASDAQ down about 0.5%. But as we've been saying, Tim and I have been talking about, really, it's the moves in the bond market that are pretty significant today. And you've got that 10-year at 3.41, two-year note with a yield of 4.25. But you've seen investors moving into treasuries and pushing those yields lower today.
Yeah, a little bit of pessimism pessimism that we're seeing over in the bond market. Let's get into it with David Hardin, CIO of the registered investment advisor Summit Global Investments. They've got over $2 billion in assets under management. David joins us this afternoon from Salt Lake City, Utah. David, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to start, the bond market. What are you seeing there? I'm actually surprised, given the moves that we're seeing in the bond market, that equities aren't reacting more.
Well, I think people are still a little bit focused on the possibility of this Powell pivot. I think that's in people's minds and hopes. I think maybe they're wanting that under their Christmas tree, if you will. And so I think the stocks are a little bit more focused on him playing Santa Claus for us. But in all reality, the bond market might have it right. They seem to get it right a lot more often. So we have to pay attention to that move.
Yeah, I mean, the bond market, demand for longer-dated bonds drove a yield inversion to a four-decade extreme, sending 10-year rates below those on the two-year notes by the most since the early 1980s. So that is pretty extreme. At the same time, I'm looking a little bit at what's happening in equities. You had MasterCard announce a $9 billion share buyback on December 6th. Lowe's is rallying in what is an overall down market today after the company reaffirmed its annual forecast, gave its initial view for next year, and announced a new $15 billion share buyback. Do you feel like, Dave, this is the beginning of companies, publicly held companies, not sure what to do right now and worried about the outlook that we're going to see kind of the rollout of the buybacks?
I think the buybacks have been successful in the sense of the return. If you look at the returns year to date, yields and buybacks combined with higher yields, the company giving back to their shareholders, has definitely been the winner year to date. There's no doubt about that. So I think that's definitely out there. And yeah, you're going to see more companies trying to find out how can we raise our share prices, and following the winners is not a bad strategy. But the reality is there's also just a lot of other things in the market that are going to cause us to pause. I mean, being up about 14 to 17% since the lows in say, August, we've rallied tremendously. So giving back 20%, we're only going to be back to where we were in August or what have you. So I think the market has a lot of potential dry powder that we have to be very careful of.
What about when it comes to lower lows than we saw back in October? Do we see those coming?
If you study the bear markets of the past, say in the 70s specifically, because they had a lot of inflation in the 70s like we have today, there were times when the market rallied up 50% and yet continued to go downwards. If you think in 1974, Arthur Burns raised rates, or cut rates, excuse me, and the market rallied 50%, but yet the 70s were a big bear on the market. So the answer to your question is ultimately yes. It's very possible that we retest those low lows and we get back to there rather quickly. Just what's going to stop? What's going to be the catalyst? That's the crystal ball that's hard to tell.
Yeah, I guess some of it depends on if indeed we go into recession, how deep and wide that recession is, and what it does to corporate earnings and kind of a reset on valuations. Having said that, Dave, there are some names that you like, and this kind of gets to what Romain on our TV side said. You know, I mentioned a commentary that someone made about you got to be in this market, basically. And he's like, well, do you got to be in individual stocks or do you got to be in the overall equity trade kind of all in? You do like CVS. Tell us what the investment thesis is behind that one.
Yeah, so the reality here is that we are stock pickers at heart and money managers in the sense of risk management. So everything we like depends on the possibility of the return minus the possibility of the downside return, right? So we're trying to minimize that downside risk. And CVS gets this for us. It has a high dividend growth. It has high unlevered free cash flow. So you're looking at quality earnings here, a lower earnings variability. It's an industry that everybody can get their arms around and understand. And let's face it, even in a recession, there's still a lot of health problems in America, the way that we eat and the other problems we have. So we really like this, and we consider this healthcare is a really good buy for us right now.
Is it more of the Aetna part of it, or is it more of the retail pharmacy locations, or is it both?
I think it's both. I think both have their value that they're adding, and they're in a little bit different areas of the healthcare market. And so, yeah, there's a lot of positive to be seen here with this company right now.
All right. So in the energy space, you like ConocoPhillips. And we know that if you look at the 11 major industry groups in the S&P 500, atop that list, and I think the only major group that's up for the year is the energy names, or are the energy names. Year to date, ConocoPhillips is up almost 63%. What is it about Conoco specifically?
Well, there's a couple things about Conoco. First of all, both their top and bottom line earnings have been above consensus. They've been extremely favorable in their yield. They're a top leader in their space. So from a company in energy, we really like ConocoPhillips. As a sector, think about that. It's up that much, but yet oil's off 30% from its highs in June. And here we are at $75, $74 a barrel, and yet we have more possible geopolitical issues going on with Ukraine and Russia and drones going over, and we have OPEC, and your previous caller talked about Russia and China and all sorts of things. So we see that the energy sector is a sector you have to have exposure to. Even though it's up 60%, it's not time to short that sector.
But that just has to do with the longer-term trends, right, in terms of a shift to alternative energy fuels and maybe not so much new drilling going on and so on and so forth. I mean, the fundamentals make sense why you're going to see maybe these energy names continue to trend higher.
In and of themselves, the fundamentals are winning out here. Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about chips just very briefly. We've got 30 seconds left. Intel, another pick for you. Why Intel?
Well, Intel is actually one that I would probably avoid at the current time. They have a potential dividend cut, I think. They've had negative correlation to rate hikes. And even though Powell might pivot, we all think interest rates here for a little bit longer. We're feeling it every day. So that impacts the dollar, negatively impacts chips because they have so much revenue coming from overseas. They have negative free cash flow right now. So I like some chips. Intel's one that I would probably avoid. If you're in it, I would consider maybe switching to another.
Yeah, Intel down about 45% so far this year. And the company, we've got a story in the Bloomberg just a couple days ago, Intel saying it's on course to regain chip production leadership. They are trying to kind of right their ship, if you will. They've been the behemoth, but it's been a bit tricky. Dave Harden, CIO of the Registered Investment Advisor, Summit Global Investments, $2 billion in assets under management, on the phone from Utah. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us live on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Business Week, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.